Welcome to PS Editors Podcast, where we engage PS contributors and other experts on some of the day's most pressing issues. I'm Greg Bruno, an associate editor at Project Syndicate in Prague. Today, we're talking about China. Chinese President Xi Jinping has made rooting out corruption a signature piece of his governing strategy. Since coming to power in 2012, tens of thousands of party officials have been caught up in his anti-corruption dragnet. But vows to target corruption are as old as the modern Chinese state. During China's Communist Revolution, peasants supported the new regime in part because Mao Zedong promised a government that would be gongdao, fair and equitable. Today, however, corruption is a defining characteristic of Chinese politics and business. My guest today has spent years studying political and economic reform in China. Andrew Sheng is a former chairman of the Hong Kong Securities and Futures Commission, a former deputy chair of the Hong Kong Monetary Authority, and a distinguished fellow of the Asia Global Institute at the University of Hong Kong. Andrew is also a longtime PS columnist, and he has some thoughts on how China's president might succeed where others have failed. Let's give him a call. Hi, Andrew.
Hi, how are you?
I'm great. Thanks for joining us on PS Editor's Podcast today.
Thank you.
So let's get right to the conversation. You've written quite a bit about China's corruption challenges. Can you give us a brief overview of the Chinese president's current anti-corruption efforts?
Well, I think President Xi has put anti-corruption right at the kind of a heart of his strategy to clean up the bureaucracy, the party, and the military, right? You know, this has received quite a lot of people's support because in the last, let's say, 20 years, corruption has reached a level in which a lot of people feel that, you know, that is unacceptable. And the strength of the anti-corruption campaign, particularly in the last 5 years, when he assumed the you know, the leadership of the party, the scale, the depth, and the length of the anti-corruption campaign is unprecedented in Chinese history, and that has brought him a lot of both kudos and popular support, and that has also clean up the administration in order for him to build on the next 5 years. And that was the context in which his 19th Party Congress report was made.
Well, it's interesting. You mentioned history. The Chinese have been living with some form of corruption for many years throughout history, in fact. I mean, imperial courts in the 19th century were rife with bribery. You know, more recently, there have been efforts to clean up the civil service and some of those issues and promotion, you know, anti-corruption drives have not been that successful. But I wonder, in a country like China that's often described as a fragmented model of government, how do you root out these cozy and often incestuous relationships?
Well, you know, no country is free of corruption. All bureaucracies are prone to capture, okay? All human beings are susceptible to temptation, greed, for both position, power, status, and all the trimmings that come with it. What one does not appreciate is that the arrival of the Communist Party, the succession to power in 1949, introduced a major bureaucratic or institutional innovation to Chinese dynastic structures. Until the demise of the Qing dynasty in 1911, competitive exams were the way to, you know, to select the best and the brightest of Chinese talent into the bureaucracy. And because they were infused with the classics, in which morality stands at the height of it, at the core of it, there was always a perpetual struggle between the morality of public service versus the individual greed and the corruption of the system. Now, under the imperial system of dynasties, it was not easy for a imperial family to control this. And, different innovations by creating inspectorates, independent audit commissions, what they call censorate, has not fully succeeded, because it depended very much upon a individual leadership within the dynasty. The Communist Party of China actually was an institutional innovation, because it was a highly disciplined structure that honed its practical skills of controlling the military during the Long March and then the Civil War. So the ability of the party organization to implement policy and making sure that policies implemented by the bureaucracy, which in China is huge, was much more effective. Now, before the marketization of the economy, this was relatively less of a problem. Corruption was less of a problem. And the reason is that, throughout history, the state was roughly, in terms of expenditure and revenue, was never more than 10% of GDP in cash terms. Right. Of course, people supplied the labor on top of that. But as the market deepened, particularly after the 78-79 reforms, the opportunities of corruption then rose, many cadres fell by the wayside.
Right.
So the old issues of overspending, extravagant spending, nepotism, came back. And it reached a stage when Mr. Xi came in, he realized that this was the root of the legitimacy and credibility of the party. And therefore, he embarked on this very necessary and welcome by the Chinese people, the reforms, which brought down what is commonly called both tigers. 440 people of the ministerial rank, and also the flies, and that means the lower level, disciplines. Yeah. So this is huge by any standards.
So it's interesting, the differentiation between the imperial period and the communist period. One of the things that I think a lot of folks don't fully understand, and I use the word fragmented, from a top-down policy perspective, the Communist Party exerts a lot of control, but from a bottom-up implementation of those policies, there is often a lot of autonomy, especially on economic issues. One of the places that we see some of the biggest opportunity for local interpretation, but also for corruption, is on land policies. Interestingly, rural land is often collectivized, and individuals are not always fairly compensated when local governments take the land for development initiatives or agriculture. Protests have been increasingly common. And one could argue this is a type of response to what is perceived locally, a corrupt system. Can anti-corruption efforts currently underway address these types of systemic challenges?
Well, there are two issues here. I think the first one is the laws relating to the bidding of public lands, right? As you know, the Chinese operate a system of land leases, not perpetual land being sold in perpetuity. So the local governments actually grant leases, okay? And because they learned the land as a revenue from the Hong Kong and Singapore city models, they actually have developed fairly transparent, open bidding systems. But the trouble is, of course, that, how you acquire such land from whoever was using it before for public and then, the sale purposes, it tends to be arbitrary, right?
Right.
The point is that if this piece of land is needed for a highway and the highway would bring lots of social benefits to the country, that's not an issue. The Chinese have been able to, even the farmers, they may not be too happy about it, but by and large, they've been compensated. And because they see that that piece of land has been for public use, okay? And it has brought common prosperity, etc. Where they get very upset is that the land was acquired at fairly low prices, and then suddenly, you know, sold to the highest bidder, and the developer then makes, you know, massive fortunes, you know, from the sale of, you know, the apartments on such land. And then there's this great feeling of injustice. Mm. And of course, particularly when they, you know, you've heard the story about the nail houses.
The single
house who refuses to give
out. Were
the holdouts. And then, you know, the local governments apply under common law will not be accepted. Then this brings a lot of grievances. So I think the corruption, you know, is at different levels. The areas where, you know, it's, you know, where they know how to use the market, that's that there are good solutions to that. But at the same time, the way the policy, the city planning is done, the choice of land for what use, etc., would be much more arbitrary and much more prone to the kind of corruption issues which have surfaced. And that explains why, as an economy becomes more market oriented and more complex, it needs a very different set of rules. You know, it's not easy to just to say, well, you know, let's borrow a set of rules and implement it, you know, in this country, if that country doesn't have the same traditions of common law, etc.
Right.
And that's why people tend to forget that within China, a lot of the basis of law, which was introduced, you know, up the post 1911 reforms, were very much based on European continental law, not necessarily the Anglo-Saxon common law that, you know, most Western media refers to, right? And that continental laws have, you know, very different checks and balances within the system. So to a large extent, the Chinese are still feeling the stones by crossing the river. Mm. In trying to establish what they call the rule-based system.
Right. Corruption is a challenging issue for any Chinese leader to deal with, given that many Chinese leaders are rarely squeaky clean themselves. We just have to remember revelations about the family of Wen Jiabao to remember that. So for Xi, I wonder, is this really about transparency and clean government, or is there something else going on? Is there potentially a desire for marginalization of political rivals, for example?
Well, everybody who undertakes that action will be accused of tackling political rivals. This is true in any country, right? The issue here really is that I think within his own upbringing, you know, for example, his father's very reformist and very idealistic record, Mr. Xi has very strong feelings about the need to get the party on the right moral and nation-building track. If needs be, of trying to get some of the toughest guys, that's what he's done. Now, you know, one will never be able to completely remove accusations by opponents that this is for, you know, whoever's interests. The point is that for what he perceives and what a lot of Chinese citizens perceive as the greater good for a cleaner, greener society, some tough measures have been taken. Some tough measures were taken.
Hmm.
And that's what the common phrase about gnawing the bones really means. It means that, you know, if you really have to take the tough decisions, you just have to take the tough decisions.
Hmm. What's that phrase?
Kenguto, you have to, you know, you have to gnaw the bones. That means, you know, it's very tough, but you still have to carry on.
Right. Yeah, it's interesting in that this issue plays really well with publics. And in a country like China, that's complicated to understand, the public opinion still matters, even in a very top-down authoritarian type political structure. Public opinion is very important.
Well, public opinion in China has always been important. The Chinese have a phrase which, you know, can be translated in modern terms as public opinion. It says "yulun," what the social debate is all about. And you know, the one of the things that kept the Chinese bureaucracy on track always has not just been the issue of morality, but how one is judged by history, right? The point is that if something, you know, a moment in time comes up when you have to be judged by history, and Chinese historians from the time of the Grand Historian has upheld the tradition of trying to speak truth to power. Not that it always succeeds, because as we know, even the Grand Historian's father was beheaded for recording something not pleasant to the emperor. But the issue has been that, you know, because Chinese leaders always understand that history looks upon them and will judge them, they then take, you know, the important path forward. A simple example is that rightly or wrongly, the Communist Party was seen as trying to defend China against the Japanese invaders during the Second World War, and the Nationalist Party was seen as trying to get rid of its opponents first, right? The morality of the issue was who stood up, and therefore I am not surprised that this present generation of leadership is basically saying, look, you know, and you see this throughout the 19th Party Congress report, that China needs to get back to its own, you know, greatness.
Right.
And there's the different debate on what that greatness means. The Chinese always feel that they are a civilization, and that the civilization is due its respects, and it wasn't given that respect when it was a very weak economic, particularly in military power.
Right. Yeah. The question of humiliation throughout history plays very strong. You know, and the idea, maybe this is a good place to kind of turn to solutions and wrapping up, the promise that Mao Zedong and the Communist Party came forward with during that period that you just referred to was the idea of a Gongdao government, a fair and equitable government. And for a while, it seemed to work, but here we are again talking about rooting out corruption. So what makes Xi successful this time in his drive to deal with this challenge that past leaders haven't been able to manage?
Well, you know, the point is that, as we know, social inequality has worsened everywhere, right? In the West, inequalities have now reached a level in which, populist leaders have come up to disrupt the establishment. To a large extent, you know, the 19th Party Congress report was a recognition, as well as a blueprint, that the old order has changed, and that China is at a turning point, and that if China wants to reach where it wants to achieve as a what is now called a China dream, but essentially a prosperous, modern, innovative, and strong nation, major reforms need to be made. And therefore, within their own terms, they recognize that a strong party comes with it, a disciplined party comes with it, and that needs to make some very tough decisions on social inequalities. And if you then look at the detailed work plan, you will see the need to correct the social inequities through improving social welfare, social protection, retirement schemes, improving education, access of education, dealing with the regional imbalances, income and wealth imbalances, and all the things that many societies, democratic or otherwise, talk about, but have difficulty in achieving. So the issue has arisen in which this party Congress has given the mandate to the party to achieve this with the full recognition that many of the issues and the legacies give rise to new contradictions and new challenges that China has never encountered before, and let alone any country of that size. So people tend to forget that the large country problems will face the same issue. India will face the same issue, in which you have to eradicate, large-scale poverty. And how do you do this in an age of massive technological disruption, job destruction, et cetera, and in the face of very challenging geopolitical tensions, at the same time with very drastic climate change and demographic changes, is a huge task. So the 19th Party Congress report is a fairly realistic blueprint that recognizes these internal challenges and contradictions, and basically says, look, you know, if you want to be strong, gird up your muscles and bones and get on with the job. And that's what the report is essentially about.
Well, it sounds like China's time is now, and the dream is within reach. And the Chinese people are certainly behind their president. So that was a fascinating conversation. I'd like to thank you very much for your time today.
Thank you. I think one should not dismiss the fact that, you know, there are a lot of very, very difficult issues within China. And I would like to say, you know, China is governed by the law of large numbers. If it is one-fifth of mankind, one-fifth of the world's problems exist in China. And therefore, just changing them has not been easy and will not be easy.
That's a fantastic place to leave it. One-fifth of the world's problems. As they say, Godspeed.
Thank you.
Well, Andrew, thanks very much. That was fantastic.
Thank you.
All right. 谢谢你, 再见.
再见, 再见.
That was Andrew Shang, a distinguished fellow of the Asia Global Institute at the University of Hong Kong. That's all for this episode. Thanks for listening. Be sure to rate and review our podcast and subscribe on SoundCloud, Stitcher, and iTunes. And if you like our content, our annual magazine is available for order now. Head on over to our website, prosyn.org, to order your copy.